face, stunning implications, which is one of the things that makes them fun, as do their curious corollaries. The work I'm talking about is work that's been done in collaboration with Dan Wesley at Cambridge University. I should say at the outset that the work I'm going to be talking about is work which is still very formulative. The theorems I'll be presenting to you are all rigorously proven. That's not the part that's formulative, but we are still developing a lot more interesting theorems and corollaries as we go along, and we're still trying to understand the relationship between what we're doing, which uses what I will call some kinds of primitive tools, compared to the kind of work we heard about this morning from Kumrum, or that we'll hear this afternoon from Ava or from others later, which are using more sophisticated mathematical tools. So what we're doing is, as I said, in some sense, comparatively primitive. I should say the basic theme of this talk is summarized in this figure, which was fortuitously placed here, which is that when you try to accelerate the universe, this sort of represents what extra dimensions like to do. They don't respond nicely. The question is, how badly do they respond? OK, so we're going to be talking about complements, but is not really directly related to the kinds of no-go theorems that are based on assumptions of supersymmetry and supergravity. In fact, I won't be making those specific assumptions. Or those based on, let's say, inflation when one talks about constraints on eta or epsilon. I won't be assuming any of those kinds of constraints. Or the kind of detailed constructions that we were hearing about this morning, or we'll hear later, coming from string theory and the string landscape. It's using ideas which are complementary and, as I said, somewhere simpler and more primitive. And the question, one of the questions that's open is, how do the two fit together? It is more closely related to constraints that have been placed on static De Sitter models, for example, by these various authors, in which they've assumed, well, the strong energy condition, which for an ideal fluid means rho plus Vp greater than or equal to 0. And the differences are that, number one, here we're interested in the more practical case of the real universe in which we're not static. The equation of state of the universe is evolving with time. We want to see what constraints we can find then. And we're not going to be interested in the strong energy condition or variance of that, but we're going to be interested in the slightly more frightening and dangerous null energy condition under conditions under which you violate that. The work is directly related to, in fact, founded on a beautiful paper written by Dan Wesley, which really establishes a lot of the mathematical methodology that, that we employ, and which establishes some theorems which I won't be proving today, but which is interesting. So if you want to learn more about this work, this is an excellent place to start. OK. I'm going to begin. I'm just going to march through a series of theorems and corollaries. And the first one, I'll spend some time showing you how we prove it. And then after that, well, you'll kind of get the idea of the method. And hopefully, you'll believe me that they're proven. So the idea of each of these theorems is that we begin with a certain set of assumptions, and then we work out the consequences if you can combine those assumptions with the idea that the universe is expansion of the universe is accelerating. So I'm going to call this first set of assumptions the theorem one assumptions. And I'm just going to write them again here in shorthand on the board, because as we go on, you might want to refer to them to see what's wrong or what you might want to change. So the first of those assumptions is simply that you begin with some theory, which is that the fundamental theory of physics is somehow a projection of some theory with a higher number of dimensions. And for the particular theorems I'm going to prove to you, it applies specifically for the case of dimensions between 5 and 13 exclusively. Variants are proved for other choices of D. Secondly, we'll assume that the higher dimensional theory is well described by Einstein's theory of general relativity, as is, of course, the low energy 4D effective theory. And what our constraints have to do with is what happens when you try to have a theory which is both described by four-dimensional effective GR and higher dimensional effective GR and has cosmic acceleration. Three, we'll assume a certain form for the metric and for the theorem that I'm going to prove to you today. They reply to the case where you have conformally Ricci flat metrics. So one can think about other variations, but we'll be thinking about cases where the metric can be written in the form of a warp factor times usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker plus another warp factor times something, a metric GAB, where we'll assume that this metric GAB is a Ricci flat, so R is equal to 0. And this applies to several range of interesting theories, including many theories which involving flux compactifications with Calabi-Yau. So it's interesting for that reason. We'll be assuming the extra dimensions are closed or bounded. And we'll be assuming, for this first set of theorems, we'll be assuming the null energy condition is satisfied. Okay. Now, with those theorems, the first thing we'll prove is that in that case, the total equation state of the universe, the ratio of the pressure to the density, that means I'm including all ingredients in it, that always must be strictly greater than or equal to minus 1. So some words about the technology. So the first thing I should say is when we're going to talk about things like pressure or density or equation of state, it's important to tell you that I'm always going to be doing my calculations in both in 4D and in the higher dimension in Einstein frame. So that makes W and pressure unambiguous quantities. There's only one time in this talk I'm going to deviate, or one period time in this talk I'm going to be deviating from Einstein frame, and that's when I talk about observations. When we have situations in which moduli are changing with time, in terms of observational constraints, that's related to constraints on models in which Newton's constant is changing with time. Observers like to express their results in terms of how much G Newton could be changing with time, but that's obviously not Einstein frame. So what I have to do then is take the theories I'm talking about, convert them to Einstein frame, see what consequence they have for the observations, and then go back again and see how they constrain one another. But other than that, I'm always talking about Einstein frame. The energy momentum tensor, well, it could be quite general, but what we will be doing for the purposes of this discussion is is using the fact that you, for this metric, doesn't erase very well. But this metric, you can, although it's not, the energy momentum tensor need not be, strictly speaking, block diagonal. It has a 0, 0 component, which we'll be calling rho. It has a the three-dimensional block of components, which if it's homogeneous, if it's interested in describing nearly homogeneous and isotropic universes, will in fact be diagonal, but for our purposes, I can just parameterize it in terms of a single parameter called P3, which is the trace average, the trace divided by 3 for that block. These components have to be 0 for that metric, and I can similarly describe something which is the trace average, PK, for this block as well. So I don't care the block whether it really is diagonal, but the quantity I'll be interested in is the 1 over k, the number of compact dimensions times the trace. And that quantity I'll call pk. And the reason why that's sufficient for our purposes is because if we can prove things about rho plus pk or rho plus p3 being negative, then you can show by a little lemma that's in Dan Wesley's paper that shows that there must exist some null vector n mu such that t mu nu, n mu, n nu is less than 0. That is to say that you violate null energy. So in other words, it suffices to focus on those quantities, rho plus pk, rho plus p3. If you can show those are less than 0, then your theory must violate null energy. Now those quantities, rho, p3, and pk, are not the same as rho 4d and p4d, are not the same as the density and pressure that would appear as sources in the 4D Einstein equations, but you can relate the two given any particular model. Okay, a key trick, we have a little bag of tricks that we use, but a key trick is the idea of what's called averaging. The thing we want to ask is, do we violate the null energy condition? For that, we want to know if there's any null vector n at any point in space-time such that tmn, nm, nn is less than 0. If that is true, then we violate null energy. But searching all of space-time and all null vectors may be hard. So it actually suffices for purposes of the theorems I'll show you to consider what I'll call a volume averaged, or more generally, a averaged value, expectation of Tmn, Mn, Nn. That is to say, I integrate over the compact volume with a weight function e to the a omega, where omega is the work factor. So omega may be a function of time and the internal coordinates, say, but I just simply perform this weighted integral divided by the volume integral. Okay, there should be an integral on the left-hand side, obviously. Okay. The point is that if I can show you that the A average value of rho plus P, say, or Tmn, Nm, Nn, if I can show you that it's less than zero for the weighted volume average, then there must be a point, if it's negative for that weighted volume average, it must be negative for at least one space-time point. So that means it must violate the null energy condition. Of course, the converse is not true. If it turns out the weighted integral is positive, it doesn't prove that we haven't violated the null energy condition. You could. It just could be that you didn't show up in the weighted average integral. But we'll be more interested in the, that's not essential for our purpose. Okay, let's get to work on our theorem. We want to consider the possibility that the metric changes with time. It could scale with time with some function c, which could be a function of time and the internal coordinate. There could be, in addition, some trace-free component sigma ab, which is also a function of time and the internal component, coordinate. We then plug this into the higher-dimensional Einstein equations, and we begin to isolate quantities that we're interested in. So all we're doing is using the higher-dimensional Einstein equations to compute things like the weighted average of rho plus p3, or the weighted average of rho plus pk. And the thing to know is that if either of those is negative, that represents a violation of the null energy condition. Okay? So let's consider, let's say, the first one, the rho plus p3 one. Okay, so the first term, we've isolated things which depend on the 4D variables, the 4D energy density and the effect of 4D pressure. So if you live in a universe which has, like we do today, where W is greater than zero, I'm sorry, where 1 plus W is greater than zero, W today is around minus 0.7, where 1 plus W is greater than zero, then that's a positive quantity. But in general, if you don't violate the null energy condition, it could be, it's always positive for any one, for any W. Then there's a second term, which the only important thing to know about it is that it's negative semi-definite. And there's a third term, which I didn't write out the details, but involves C and the warp factor. It's also negative semi-definite. And that's all we need to know about it. Now, the second relation is a little bit more interesting. The first term in there is rho plus 3. It's proportional to rho plus 3 p4d. So that means it's proportional to 1 plus 3 w. And that quantity becomes negative the moment W becomes less than minus a third. And as you know, minus a third is the threshold for acceleration. So the moment you begin accelerating, this quantity turns negative. And this is W total. That's matter plus dark energy. Today, as I told you, we live in a universe with around Joe just taught us was that we live with WMAP data, we live in a universe which is around minus 0.7. And so we are in this condition. Now, these other quantities depend upon what value of A weighting I use. But if I choose a clever value of A weighting, a clever choice of A, I can make all those terms on the right negative semi-definite. Therefore, the only way I can save myself from making the last term negative, that is to say, violating the null energy condition, is to make this middle term positive. Okay? Which means that the modulus field, C, must be non-zero, and its time derivative must be non-zero. And that's where the fun begins. So let's do a worked example, the case of De Sitter, static De Sitter. W total is minus 1. All we have in the universe is lambda. OK, so let's see. If we look at the first term, I said in general that first term is proportional to 1 plus W total. But for this example, W total is precisely minus 1. So it's precisely equal to 0. So we are in the threshold of trouble. All those terms are zero or less than zero. And we want to make sure that thing is positive or we violate. What about the last one? The last one, 1 plus W, if W is minus 1, is minus 2. So we are in real, even more a threat of violating the null energy condition from the last one. The only way we can save ourselves from that is to make that middle term positive. But to make that middle term positive means C or its time derivative must be non-zero. And then uh-oh, the middle term becomes non-zero, and we violate up there. So you're trapped. You can't get by without violating the null energy condition in this case. There you have it. Given these conditions, W total must be strict, cannot be minus 1. It must be strictly greater than minus 1. That is now a rigorously proven theorem without much more technology other than those few little tricks I outlined at the beginning. Okay. Well, that's pretty interesting. Curious corollary is means that not only is pure lambda ruled out, but means that lambda CDM is ruled out, because lambda CDM, the model that Joe explained to us as a favored model, has as a fixed point W equals minus 1. And we just said that's inconsistent with these. So if these theorems are true, lambda CDM must be wrong, and the fixed point must not be minus 1. W dark energy must not be minus 1. It must be strictly greater than minus 1. Now, you might worry, given that observers tell us that W is close to minus 1, can we say that these conditions are ruled out observationally? That's an interesting question. For that, I will employ two other theorems. But I won't prove in front of you. Theorem 2 says that if all the conditions of theorem 1 are satisfied, and if W total lies between minus a third and a certain W critical, which I will describe to you in a moment, then, in fact, you can have cosmic acceleration. You can maintain it for an indefinite period of time, but at a cost. Newton's constant must vary with time to maintain you're not violating the null energy condition. So we are, in fact, so we can first of all ask, though, about this W critical. So we can maintain acceleration forever, provided W is greater than W critical. What is this W critical? Well, it turns out to be dependent upon the number of dimensions and the fact that these dimensions are closed. So here's a plot of W total versus number of dimensions, and that red curve represents W critical. And for example, for an interesting number of dimensions, you might say there are 6 extra dimensions, or 7 extra dimensions, or 8 extra dimensions. W total, that critical line corresponds at that point to around minus 0.53. And we already live in a universe with minus 0.7, closer to minus 0.73. We are below that line today. So observations say, you know, this is not in the observational range. This is inconsistent with observations. We can't live a universe that continues to accelerate at the current rate. That's pretty interesting. Now, theorem 3 says, now case 2, suppose W lies between this W critical and minus 1. What happens then? Well, what happens then is that you can maintain the acceleration. You can maintain the value of W below W critical, but only for a very short period of time. And by a short period of time, I mean only about an e-fold or two, which means W is not constant. W dark energy is not constant. It has to be changing with time, given the present circumstance. And not only must W change with time, but you still have the fact that the Newton's constant must change with time. So can we satisfy all observed conditions with those? Can we satisfy those two conditions? So let's take the practical example where W total today is minus 0.73. Then what? We want to compare that to current limits on Newton's constant. And when you compare, you have to actually compare with two kinds of limits. Limits on the present day value of G dot over G based on, say, pulsar timing or stellar evolution, and also integrated limits of the change of G since nucleosynthesis. So we have to satisfy those constraints. And we also have to satisfy constraints from WMAP, supernova, et cetera, on how big dW dz can be. And that's, roughly speaking, the current limit. So let's first of all consider the limits on W and its time variation. So you can express this in various ways. Observers express these limits in various ways. I've sort of plotted in a way which is analogous to the way observers often talk about this problem when comparing to observations, in which they assume that W as a function of scale factor takes some simple form where W0 represents today's value, WA represents its linear variation with scale factor, WB would represent its second order, et cetera. And then we're interested in a plot in the plane of W0 versus its time derivative, or a derivative, WA, what is the range which is allowed? So first of all, we can ask, what is the range which, well, first of all, I restricted myself, unlike most of the plots you'll see, probably later in this meeting, I restricted myself to W0 strictly greater than or equal to minus 1 because I'm interested in not violating the null energy condition, and things on that end violate the null energy condition. The phone call is not about the null energy condition. Lambda in this, WA is along this axis. Lambda corresponds to WA equals 0, so that's where the arrow points. We first of all plot in this plane, we first of all carve out the regions which don't violate the 4D null energy condition, not just today, but in the past. So that gives us a slight restriction, gives us most of this region. And then finally, we look at the region which doesn't violate in higher dimensions up to this point, and that gives you this region. We look for the overlap. And so this is the region which, at least to this point in time, would not have to have violated the null energy condition in either 4 dimensions or 5 dimensions and still agree with everything we know. And it's a fairly large region. And by the way, it has a little hole that keeps it away from lambda, which is, turns out to be interesting to observers. Okay. So in fact, what do we know observationally? We know W naught, for example, is greater than, choose your favorite today's value, minus 0.95 or so, somewhere around here to the right. We know all this is excluded. Okay? Now, as you get closer to the left, of course, that's where observers are very eager to look. And how are they going to look? Well, the proposal to look is by improving measurements from the ground and also to spend $1 billion or so in space in a project which is under the general name of the Joint Dark Energy Mission, or JDAM mission. And the red line on the right represents how far, latest reports suggest one can go by working from the ground, so a little bit farther than where we are now. And then with a JDAM satellite, you can push from that red line all the way into that inner circle. So you're sort of covering that annulus in between. And what you can see is that what we can't get from the ground, a good fraction of what's left is covered by JDAM. So interestingly enough, this is a great motivation for doing JDAM, checking whether or not, if extra dimensions are right, they obey these conditions. You can test almost the entire range of allowed parameters. I should warn you, this is preliminary. This is not the final version of this plot. We'll do a little bit of tuning, but the qualitative result is correct, that almost everything can be examined by JDAM. There's a little piece that's in the bad region over there, but it turns out you can even go after that because we expect to also improve our measurements on G dot over G. If you took at the present 3 sigma limits on, 3 sigma upper bound limits on the variation in G, that doesn't rule out anything. But we're right on the edge of doing something interesting. So for example, if we improve them by an order of magnitude, which is conceivable with near future pulsar measurements, that will begin to rule out this part of parameter space. And so between the two measurements, at least in this in this preliminary plot, you actually can hit everything. So that's interesting. Are the theorem one conditions ruled out? No, not yet. Although the situation could change dramatically within forthcoming experiments. And as a little side note, maybe the JDAM mission should be renamed the JDAM mission, Joint Extra Dimensions Mission. Okay. Now, here's another interesting corollary. We said that when you try to accelerate the universe with dark energy, the extra dimensions want to respond, and you need the null. And that's where you run up against the null energy condition. If you think it's bad for dark energy, it's much worse for inflation. Because you see, with dark energy, it's okay if at the moment we're heading towards W equals minus 1, but we haven't yet gotten there. We haven't spent a lot of time there. We've only been accelerating since the universe was 9 billion years old. So that's less than half an it's only about half an e-fold. Whereas we could have gone for a couple of e-folds. But of course, for inflation, we want to be close to W equals minus 1 for 60 e-folds or more. And that is impossible. So in fact, inflation requires, absolutely requires, violating at least one of these conditions. Conversely, with these conditions, you can't have good inflation. You can't have inflation that would give you an acceptable tilt, for example. You never get close to W equals minus 1. So it actually provides, at least for an interesting counterexample to the common view, which says that inflation's inevitable. Okay, you start a system with some sort of chaotic initial conditions, and inevitably, even if it begins chaotically, little pockets will inflate and take over the universe. No, here's a whole class of miles where that can't happen. You can't ever have good inflation with this class of models. You might have to do something else to smooth and flatten the universe, but that's the subject of another talk. Okay. So now, if we want to go on, maybe we should think about alternatives. So my next set of theorems have to do with the case where we're going to give up one of these conditions. And the one that I'm going to give up is the null energy condition. And because it's interesting things to be said in that case, I'm going to assume in this case that I'm not going to allow Gn to vary, or at least not very, very fast. So I'll assume that even if, you know, with an order of magnitude improvement, we wouldn't see any change in Gn. And then the following theorems hold. OK, and then you can show that if I'm fixing G and I'm allowing null energy to violate, I can begin to learn about when and how null energy condition must be violated. So for example, I can show that there's a value of A, which I'll just call A star, such that the null energy condition must be violated the moment W becomes less than minus a third for rho plus pk. So specifically I'm actually being localized where this null energy violation is occurring. It's occurring within the compact dimensions. That's what that says. And it occurs the moment W falls below minus a third. That means it's active today. Okay. I can further show that for that same value of A star, null energy condition is satisfied when W is greater than minus a third. So something has happened as we cross the threshold to acceleration, where whatever's happening in the extra dimensions, okay, it's changed from null energy, for this value of A star, it's changed from null energy satisfying to null energy violating. So that's already telling you something interesting about the compact dimensions in this null energy violation, whatever source it is. Okay, it's not, what we have is simply not matter plus lambda as we go through this acceleration. Something pretty complicated has to be happening in the extra dimensions between components which are null energy satisfying and null energy violating in such a way that they just cancel each other at this acceleration point, and then you cross from one dominating to the other dominating. And you can begin to prove a lot of these interesting theorems. I'm not going to go through all of them, but allow you to begin to dissect away this null energy has to occur. But let me just point out a couple of extra things which are interesting. If you want to avoid having Gn violating, then you actually know in detail not just that you have to have null energy violation, but the degree of null energy violation. What is the effective value of W in the extra dimensions? So for example, if you have some component J, and you don't want Gn to vary, it must be that its pressure satisfies this relation. That is to say that its pressure is proportional to 1 minus 3 W, where W should have a J on it, is the W for that component. So for example, if I were doing radiation, which is W equals a third, and you don't want to have Gn violate, then I have to have the pressure in the extra dimensions be 0. It must be, if you like, decoupled from the extra dimensions. Well, that seems pretty natural. So radiation is not a troublesome component when it comes to satisfying these conditions. Matter is more troublesome. In order to have matter, you can't just have what we normally think, cosmologists think of as dust, stuff that just has mass but doesn't interact. It has zero pressure in the three dimensions, but it must, if you don't want Gn to vary, there must be something that provides a negative pressure in the extra dimensions if you want to have a matter-dominated universe without Gn varying. Lambda, even worse. The coefficient gets bigger, minus 2. There's your null energy violation. Pk over rho is negative 2 in this case. The effective value of W for lambda is minus 2. So it's not just null violating, but it's null violating by a significant amount. And it's not maybe what you would have expected. It can't be the usual lambda. Lambda has absolute value of rho equal to absolute value of p. It can't be something like a single orientifold or a Casimir energy. Those have the same condition. You're going to have to build a complex of components in order to make something like this happen. And if you think it's bad for dark energy, it's even worse for inflation. Because if you thought about taking a model where, say, you managed to get the dark energy density right at low energies to get the present vacuum right. So you set up your null energy violation so that at low energies you have a stable vacuum, the one we're heading towards, at the cost of violating null energy. You can't get inflation simply by adding scalar fields plus potentials because they don't violate null energy. And when you want to inflate, if you don't want Gn to run, you must have a humongous null energy violation. So during inflation, That first term on the second equation, rho plus 3p, is the null violating piece. If you don't want gn to run, that means those later pieces, that middle piece is 0. So you have a huge null energy violation, which is 10^100 times greater than the null energy violation you had to put together to explain the dark energy observed today. So you have to find a source for that null energy violation. And then you have to get rid of it after inflation's over. So where's that? And that's what you have to do in order to make the theory work. So just to give you a dramatic example, many people talk about inflation occurring by brain anti-brain annihilation, occurring in some throat, assuming that you can ignore the rest of what's happening in the theory, OK? Not going to work, because brains and anti-brains and their potentials don't violate the null energy condition. So when they annihilate, that might get rid of your potential energy, but it hasn't gotten rid of your null energy violation, which had to have occurred elsewhere in the theory. So maybe you set it up initially, but now you have to get rid of it. In other words, when these brains and anti-brains annihilate in the throat, there must be some back reaction, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. You're not going to get to a radiation-dominated phase. You're going to get to a phase which maybe has radiation in it, but will have a huge null energy violating pressure in the extra dimensions. So this gives you some feeling, I think, for the power of these simple theorems based on simple mathematics, just general relativity in higher dimensions and low dimensions. And there's a lot more to come. I've just sort of scratched the surface here. Hopefully, we have lots of constraints we can apply. Hopefully, we can dissect away more and more of constraints that tell us a lot about what's going in the extra dimensions to try to see how this fits with the kinds of constructions that one is talking about, for example, in string theory or in other theories with extra dimensions. Thank you.
I have two questions. First concerns the mass of the moduli describing the extra dimensions, which you didn't mention. And it seems like if I just take that to be infinite, then I've essentially integrated out the extra dimensions, and they should play no role. And the second question is why
If they're truly infinite, I absolutely agree. They drop from the theory.
But I didn't see them playing any role. I
mean, yeah, but that would be, but that is, how should I put it? That is like violating one of these conditions, right? You didn't have an option.
Which one?
What?
Which one is it violating? Because I can do this continuously, and I should see, you know.
Oh, well, so long as it's not infinite, what will happen is when you try to accelerate the universe, there will be a back reaction. And this thing you call the mass, this thing that keeps the moduli fixed, won't be, say, a scalar field potential, because that won't have the right properties to violate null energy. It would have to be something which actually violates null energy in a way continuously to match the to match what is needed. So for example, you notice that the null energy violating we need is proportional to rho plus p in four dimensions, which is generally a time-varying quantity. So I don't just need it to be null violating. I need it to be null violating in a way which keeps up, if I don't want g to run, which keeps up this condition, which maintains this condition. So what you're calling giving it a mass has to somehow do that. What I don't know is how you do that. Okay, but that's what we're telling you. Somehow you're doing that. It could be interesting to know how.
And why not just relax this conformal Ricci flat condition? Is that
Yeah. Okay. You can do that as well. So. And then we're playing that game as well, and then you begin to run the conditions again. So the question is what to replace it with that's well motivated. And so, you know, in Dan's paper, he first of all considered the case of Ricci flat. Now we've done conformally Ricci flat. Now we, you know, we have some ideas of where to go next, but we'd be happy to take suggestions or as to what would be the most promising directions. But you're going to find, the general thing that's happening is very simple. What's happening is, generally, when you try to expand the non-compact dimensions, there's going to be some back reaction in the extra dimensions. And the faster you expand the non-compact directions, the more impetus there is for the extra dimensions to do something, the more exotic stuff you have to introduce in order to prevent something bad happening. Okay? And that's going to be fairly generic. okay, it's not going to be so sensitive to this particular structure, I think. But, that's as much as I know at present. But yeah, this is the beginning of an investigation to see what you can do.
So to come back to that point, because I think what you, well, if I look at that list of criteria, and I would also immediately relax the Ricci flatness condition, because basically what you're doing
What would you like to relax it to? I'll do that one.
I wouldn't relax it to anything at all. Basically what you're doing is you're making an ansatz for the solution, right? So actually what you have to do is just plug the whole system into the equation of motion and see what you get. I mean, by assuming this ansatz, I would think, that's just my guess, I would think that actually you're looking for, you're finding constraints that you cannot satisfy because your ansatz does not allow for a solution.
Well,
what my first guess would be. So I would like to know what certainly does.
First of all, up until we had until we knew about dark energy, it was perfectly allowed. This is perfectly consistent with the matter and radiation dominated universe. So the point is, it's the acceleration that's getting you into trouble. Now you might. So I think what we've learned, if you want to put it the other way, is we've learned, well. We shouldn't presume the answer. If we discover that W is not changing with time and GN is not changing with time, what we discovered is something is wrong here. And yeah, this is a legitimate candidate. And now you have to find a candidate which still preserves the other things you want in your higher dimensional theory and yet doesn't violate null energy, say. Okay. Now, there are some obvious candidates to look at. We'll see how they work out. But I think it's actually, my guess is it's going to be hard to find an example. But we'll see.
If you do look at the constructions that generate de Sitter space or inflation, they violate a number of these things. Perhaps most importantly, string theory constructions.
Yeah.
So they do go beyond GR and they go beyond classical string theory. But by simple ways, for example, orientifolds come at a subleading order in the expansion in the string coupling, which and give negative tension. But they're very innocuous violations of the null energy condition. They don't violate black hole thermodynamics, for example. You can't lower the area of a black hole by throwing it at an orientifold or anything crazy like that. They're very prosaic constructions from the point of view of string theory. And also, most string theories have a scalar potential even in higher dimensions, and as was already noted. The metric is not conformally Ricci flat. Once you get to Sitter constructions, as opposed to, say, the GKP, ADS ones that you referred to. So I think everything that's known is consistent with your theorem, if I understand correctly. Would you agree with that, or are you?
I'm not sure. I'm happy. I mean, I'm just saying I don't know.
The point is just, I mean, you make this assumption of conformally Ricci flatness. A purely GKP type compactification where the complex structures are fixed by fluxes has zero vacuum energy at tree level, and that is exactly conformally Ricci field. But once you add these seven brains, for instance, stabilizing the Kähler moduli, then you add an N-type brain or whatever to lift that, you are not really conformally Ricci flat anymore.
Okay.
There are corrections to that, and at that moment, this condition breaks down.
Okay. So I think, that's a well-motivated example of the next thing to look for. It doesn't mean you're safe from these theorems. It just means you have to discover if you're safe from these theorems, what they imply. What that means is you're effectively adding stress energy, which is not included in those equations up there at the present time, and they will have to play a role which is replacing the role of what I call the null energy condition violation, and they will have to obey it with time. They'll have to balance those equations over time, as ratios of components are changing with time. So the question is that possible to do? And I don't know the answer. This is what I want to know. I don't think it's proven either. I believe the claims are based on assumptions. I don't think the time-bearing solutions have been found, have they? You don't claim to have solved the cosmological solutions. I know, but I believe the inflationary solutions are assuming no back reaction.
Maybe this conversation will continue.
Okay, I need to look.
There's one last question.
Over here.
ordinarily, when a surface is embedded in a higher surface, the lower surface Einstein tensor is equal to the energy momentum tensor plus a second term, which depends on the extrinsic curvature. So the question is, in the four-dimensional part of the theory, is the term that depends on the extrinsic curvature obeying the null energy condition, and is it possible that your metric, the CRF metric, is such that it does? In which case could the generalization be, find the most general higher dimensional metric for which the extrinsic curvature term obeys the null energy condition?
I think my answer to that question is yes, you could turn it around that way, which is, you know, which is another way to search. Say, instead of assuming this, allow enough freedom that you don't violate null energy. You could ask, turn the question that way, and you could ask, does that agree with what you get in, you know, these constructions? That would be another way to address the question. Yeah.
If I want to get rid of the singularity of t equal to zero and have a bounce such that I have only a small acceleration, can I do that?
Well, it's beyond the scope of these theorems.
Sorry?
I was not trying to do anything with the singularity. I was not promising anything about the initial singularity. In fact, the opposite point of view. The idea is we know about different phases in the universe. They had to go from radiation to matter, from matter to acceleration, from matter dominated to dark energy dominated. And the interesting theorems have to do with these transitions and the different dances that have to take place in the extra dimensions in order to accomplish them. So we're sifting through lots of ideas, allowing some, you know, refuting many others, just based on those constraints, without worrying about far past or very distant future.
Okay, thank you.